You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hi, I'm Mike Pesca in for Leonard Lopate today. Economics has this tendency to replace people with numbers, souls with stats. So when we say unemployment is 7.7%, it's a pretty impersonal way to express what's happening to people, to actual people. So I guess we could say there are 12 million Americans without work. But you know about big numbers. Our minds don't really work that well. It's really hard to distinguish the difference between, say, 120,000 and 1.2 million. So then we could say things like, okay, the 12 million out of work, that's as if the entire population of Maryland and Massachusetts are without work, or if the entire population of Maine and Michigan are without work. Does that help make it real? Probably the best thing to make it real is to talk to and about people. And that's what Barbara Garson does in her new book, Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. Barbara Garson joins me now. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So, you know, the impetus behind this book, is it what I was talking about? Let's take these numbers, let's take this situation, and let's talk about people?
Well, I think I am somewhat of an economist, but it doesn't mean anything unless you see step by step how it actually works. And besides, people are terrific. Even the people in bad situations that I meet here, they always surprise me.
Yeah, and they flesh out some of the big economic stories, and sometimes they contradict what we're being told about the economy. What's an example of that you came across?
That they contradict
What we're
being told about?
You know how we're.
I'll tell you something that we just weren't being told.
Yeah.
As I interviewed people who had lost houses or jobs or money in this sudden recession, I began to realize that almost all of them or their parents had been living through a 40-year downturn.
Mm-hmm.
And I told the stories, you know, of this particular job loss and so on. But I began to realize that actually caused this recession, that people that I were talking to had been doing worse for a long time, and yet banks kept offering them bigger and bigger loans.
Right.
And I began to understand what was happening.
And we want to ask everyone who's listening that, you know, if you've lost a job, if you've been affected, or maybe the best way to put it is, how has the economic situation been made real to you? That's my question. And we're at 212-433-9692. And you can join the conversation at the show page on WNYC.org or tweet at Leonard Lopate. So it's interesting you talk about, you know, people are people, but they also represent the time in which they live. And so when you talk about someone that you knew from the moments before he was shipped out to Vietnam, and you later met up with him on an assembly line making cars.
That story.
And he Dwayne is his name?
Yes.
He encapsulates.
Well, I use fake names all the time.
Okay, so Dwayne is the
name
you call
him. I promised everybody I wouldn't use
Okay, we'll talk
names.
About that in a second. So Dwayne is a person with a life and kids, but he also encapsulates the economic moment so well.
And, you know, he died before this recession started.
Yeah.
This story was really one of the more heartbreaking to me personally because it reflects my own eras in the 1960s. Here's somebody that I met in the GI coffee houses. We had these anti-war coffee houses at Army bases. And this guy was part of the 60s where we all thought everything was going to get better and better. And when he got out of the Army, he went back home to enjoy the counterculture a little of that time. And his father was out of work. And that was just the beginnings of something that we didn't hear of much before in the 70s. And he got married. And I met him again. This was 68 when we left the coffee house. And I met him again in the 70s. And he was working at the Lordstown automobile plant, the GM plant.
In Michigan.
In Michigan.
Yeah.
In Ohio.
Ohio, okay.
And they was running the fastest assembly line in the world, 101 cars an hour. They thought they could do it because they hired all young people. And they thought, well, they won't complain like the older auto workers. Well, these guys responded to it by organized slowdowns and organized things that the company called sabotage,
mm-hmm.
except they stopped saying sabotage when they realized that it would hurt the car sales.
Yeah.
So
it's better to have a jingle, you
and
know, buy
I went
USA.
There to write about it because at the time everyone was talking about, this is the early 70s, everyone was talking about the new American workers that are going to humanize the workplace. And these guys were auto workers on strike about the speed of the line and wanting more interesting jobs. And I met him there, and he was planning to move on, even though they paid very well. Remember, we're at the beginning of the 70s, they still paid well.
Yeah.
And he was going to move on and do something else, and his wife was pregnant. He was just going to stay to use up the hospital insurance. And then I met him again in the 1980s. I was speaking at a university, and I asked him to come with us after I spoke to – no, he couldn't come. He had to pick up his children at their schools and bring them over to a sitter to go to his 4 o'clock shift, and his wife would come and pick them up at a later time from her shift.
Right.
And he was a very mechanical guy. He used to fix the machines at our coffee house. I'll show you how long ago he used to fix the mimeograph machine and the old record player. And he was doing pretty advanced technical work.
Right.
But what it was doing the computer planning for a system that would make all the other workers in his group not be skilled anymore. All the other machinists would become unskilled machinists.
Right. So he was programming the machine
right.
that would replace
That would program
the
units. Them.
But, you know...
Okay, so this is fine. He's still working. His wife has to work now, too. And she's got a neck ache every night from those old CRT computer screens that used to blink in your face. And, you know, he's an amazing guy, and he's working very hard. And finally, I hear from him. His children call me. It is 2 months before the recession.
Mm-hmm.
He died.
Mm-hmm.
I'm skipping a lot of the personal details.
Right.
He left a house to them. But because the house was underwater, because it cost so much,
yeah.
he couldn't, even if they sold the house, they would still own the bank $200,000. So here is a man who was not unemployed, who missed he managed to circulate around the offshoring and downsizing of the 80s and 90s. And still, he worked steadily his whole life, was very skilled, and he dies owing on his credit card, and a house that's got negative value, so the kids have to walk away from it.
Right. Just mail the keys to the
bank.
And
walk away.
And he's $6,000 in credit card debt.
Where his parents left him and his sister a whole house.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand this at all. And 2 months later, everything crashed.
Lehman Brothers go under and crashed.
Right. And I started to realize that this man had what statistically we now realize stagnant or declining wages over 30, 40 years. And it's a personal story to me because I didn't follow him.
Right.
I should have. He was the story that was happening in the country, not all the demonstrations I went on. And what happened over that period is we became terribly efficient.
Yeah.
Productivity increased by 25%. Wages stay stable. Americans, I know we didn't want to talk about numbers, but
no,
in America,
like
we sell 70% of what we produce to each other.
Right.
So if each other is poor or has stagnant wages, who's going to buy all the stuff?
And the thing about...
And Dwayne was an example. And yeah. what happened over that period was the money accumulated, the profits were high, the money accumulated in brokerage accounts and bank accounts.
Mm-hmm.
A bank can't keep its money in the bank.
Right.
What do you think they did? They loaned money to people like Dwayne whose incomes weren't going up.
Right.
They loaned them for cars. They loaned them for college education. Eventually, they loaned them for ridiculously priced houses that they couldn't buy. That was the last stage in a Ponzi scheme.
And the loans become the economy as opposed to work. But the thing that gets me about the story you tell about Dwayne is we've heard a variation of this story so many times. And there's a narrative like, look, we're sorry. It's never going to be like it used to be. But workers now have to get trained. Workers now can't just have a strong back and expect a middle class life. This was a guy who every step of the way consciously said, I'm going to stay ahead of the technology
curve. Right. That was his phrase.
I am not...
He and his sister, I spoke to his sister, we joked. So Wayne was going to stay ahead of it. His praise.
Right, and he saw that the economy was evolving in this way where, you know, a guy who could lift a big box is not going to be as valuable as a machine that could lift 30. And still, his legacy is 6,000 in credit card debts and a house that you have to walk with.
He was working on lasers, on industrial lasers when he died. But look at the four members of the Pink Slip Club. I met a group in Manhattan that lost their jobs at the beginning of the recession, and I give them the same names as Seinfeld, you know, Jeriel, that's Geraldine, and George. I give them all those names because they're four people in and out of each other's house all the time. And they all realize through their church, which happened to be Wiccan, but it's still like a church, they realize that they're all unemployed, and so they form this group, this club, to keep each other's spirits up through which they think will be a few weeks. Well, let them in, they think they'll enjoy free things in Manhattan, and they do at first. They go to concerts in the middle of the day and so on. But eventually, this drags on and on. Now, these people were very well trained. One is an insurance adjuster. One is an editor. One does accounts payable in a big corporation, and she really knows her stuff. One does computer graphics for publishers. And suddenly, few things are happening to them. Before they all lost their jobs, they were all kind of transformed into more, well, not all, two of them were transformed into what's happening to all the white-collar people. They become sort of temps, contractors, working by the hour, filling in. So what happened to the blue-collar people that were supposedly, this guy's obsolete anyway,
It's the information age.
It's moving up the stage. And these are information workers par excellence, constantly retraining. And they all lost jobs at the beginning of the recession, and every single one of them, I followed them, I called them. You can just see them getting more and more depressed. Well, one of them is pretty clever. She turns every opportunity to get a little part-time work. But they couldn't believe it would end this way, and they're, you know, very skilled people.
And they couldn't believe it would end this early.
They're sort of retired, basically. Only they have 15 years at least before their Social Security, and they're darling people. They're just the people you would want to have working in your company.
Yeah, and they do jobs that we need. I mean, when you open a textbook and there's a drawing there or anything that you know, one of them is an artist, and it's not like this is an obsolete skill. You need it. People just want to pay a whole lot less for it,
and not give you a working living wage for it. He does the graphics to set out the pages, the type too.
Yeah.
And the jobs are still there.
Yeah.
The jobs are still there, just everybody is doing it part-time, temp, so much per hour, and he's working now half the pay he worked before on 2 days a week. And, you know, I started getting reviews on this book, and they have been very good. Well, you know, in advance reviews are often good. But the best one I got was from a friend of mine who looked and she said, oh, now I realize that my kid isn't just a screw-up.
Right.
When she read the chapter about a completely lovely young man and his wife, they're both teachers. They haven't even lost their job in the recession. I didn't pick worst cases.
Right.
They haven't lost their job in the recession. They're each teachers. They're making about $100,000 a year. But he has he did what he was supposed to do. He invested in himself. And he has what started as an $85,000 student loan. He paid it down to $45,000 before he had living expenses when he was teaching in a school where you live in the school. And he's paying $400 or $500 a month on that.
Right.
It'll go on for 17 years.
So let's hold this story for a second, and I want to get to all these, because so many of these stories are not people who made bad choices. They're just people who are alive at this moment.
His parents think he's screwed up.
Yeah, because they lived during a different time. And we will say we are speaking with Barbara Garson about her book, Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. I'm Mike Pesca in at WNYC. Once more, I'd like to give the number in case you have stories to share with us how the recession was made real to you. Our number is 212-433-9692. You could join us at WNYC.org or tweet at Leonard Lopate. Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession, published by Doubleday. And we will have more after a break. Hi, this is Mike Peskin for Leonard Lopate on WNYC, speaking with Barbara Garson, author of Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession, published by Doubleday. We are taking your calls. How has the economy been made real to you? Are you looking for work? Do you know people who are? Has your conception of what it means to be unemployed become redefined by the latest economic travails? Our number is 212-433-9692, 212-433-9692. And before we do take a call, you said something interesting. It was an offhanded comment. You know, the real story was this worker, Dwayne, not the demonstrations that I was going on.
Right.
You were, I think, because someone left a phone call on your answering machine, they said, hey, would you like to be the vice presidential candidate for president on the socialist ticket?
I was. The president, the vice presidential candidate had died.
Yeah.
I was inactive, but I was a member. And they called me to see if they could get his obituary in the newspapers.
Uh-huh.
This is the Eugene V. Debs. Good old American Socialist Party.
Right. And he ran, how many times did he run? 8 or 9 times?
I don't know.
You know, the protests, you know, there were the 60s protests and there were protests all the way. But, you know, recently there was the Occupy Wall Street movement that sprang up about the time you were doing this research. We actually have a caller named George in Brooklyn who's asking, was the Tea Party a reaction to the economic frustration? Do you think these stories have been bubbling up either in social movements or how, you know, our politicians are conducting
themselves? The Tea Party people were sure a lot more sophisticated about economics than I was in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
We just thought things were going to get better and better.
Do you think Occupy made any tangible difference, the Occupy movement?
Well, I use the phrase 99% and people know what that means.
There you go.
And in fact, I want to apologize to them in the sense that, and I did in the book, that they did all the hard work to make that statistic mean something.
And
I sat around the square also.
Olivia in Jersey City is calling. Hello, Olivia.
Hello?
I think that was either the 4 or the 5 button. Hello, Olivia. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, go ahead.
So there's been a real problem with finding jobs, especially for students. I'm at Rutgers Law, and people with 4.0s and the highest credentials still can't find jobs. Also, one of my friends graduated from undergrad at NYU with $90,000 in loans, and just to be able to find a job, she has to take out more loans to go to law school. And it's just getting ridiculous how much loans people have to take out just to get a job starting at $40,000, $50,000.
Thank you for the call, Olivia.
I mean to write later about student loans. Those student loans of the 80s and 90s were at 8.5%, and they cannot be refinanced.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a trap. And do you know what they said when they passed those loans?
What was that?
Back in the 70s? When people said, well, that's a crazy kind of loan. Why do that to students, loans that you can't refinance and you can't go broke? They invoked me. They said, well, listen to all those kids who are talking like anarchists. They don't mean to pay their loans back. We better do something. But in fact, students weren't giving up on their loans. I mean, it was such a swindle. And like I said, I was so pleased when this woman wrote to me because her kids bought a house and the house was underwater, so they couldn't move to a better job. They had one kid. They wanted so much to have another kid, but they had an underwater house and a loan and all that kind of expenses. And the mother kept thinking, God, what's the matter with them? Don't they understand? You don't take loans.
Mm-hmm.
And blah, blah. And she said that after she read my book, she really felt a little more sympathy for her own child. She realized that it wasn't just people yeah, that lived
they weren't
too
Spencer. The old, you know, one of Clinton's.
But I must say, Obama has made the student loan thing a little better.
Well,
but the loans that are left over from the older periods.
Yeah.
They're vile. They're unbelievable.
Another important thing is, you know, 30 years ago, what was the sheer amount of money that you were taking the loan out to get a student, to get a college education?
Who
and
took
it was.
Loans?
Or you did for $2,000 instead
University
of
$50,000. University of California, Berkeley cost me $125 a term. And you notice something.
Yeah.
Now, this is the theoretical part I want to put in. These people are being loaned money, these two teachers, at a time when the prospects for two teachers are worse.
Mm-hmm.
The bank doesn't care how much it lends them because the money is, the loan is government insured.
Right.
And for the other reason that I keep coming back to, profits are so high while incomes are so low that the bank is stuck with these huge piles of money. And don't laugh. Too much money is not our problem, but it's their problem.
Yeah.
Because a bank can't keep its money in the bank. So they lend it. And those two things happening at once, incomes going down. These teachers aren't going to make more and more money to be able to pay back that loan. And the banker can figure that out in advance.
Well, you know, one of Bill Clinton's most popular lines that always tested well was talking about people who worked hard and played by the rules wanting a fair outcome. And I think in our society, it did work out. Its wages were rising
exactly.
through the 70s. Everything was fine. So the parents of those teachers, to them, that's how life works. Work hard, pay by the rules,
look,
and you don't do anything
from
wrong.
From the end of the Second World War, in fact, throughout United States history, wages went up. Hourly wages, real hourly wages, over the course of every decade, even the 1930s. They weren't all employed, but wages didn't go down.
Yeah.
Now, from the 70s on, wages have been stagnant. And there's been a huge, Reagan and all that represents the huge fight to push wages down. And you push wages down, you collect more profits in our kind of economy, what do you expect to happen?
Well, an employer listening to this might say, wages are down. Look at all these expenses because wages might not be
health
rising.
Insurance, course,
health insurance
That's
is
true.
Huge. So I think there was one statistic in your book. I like statistics where, it's true that they've made, that companies have, you know, made 25 times the, or have gone up 25 times.
In productivity.
Related to wages. But when you compare to how profitable they are compared to, you know, all their expenses, including health insurance, it's not quite as rich.
Well, but from the beginning to the end of the recession,
well, the
profits
other,
have gone up.
The other important thing about productivity, when we talk about that statistic is just, I don't know if people realize that statistic is just output divided by input. So when we say, hey, I'm going to be more productive on a personal level, it means we're producing more. But from an economic level, if a factory is producing the same amount of cat toys, I don't want to say widgets, and can do it with 50% fewer workers, it will become a more productive factory.
Yay, the more, I'm all for it.
Right, the more you...
But we thought we'd share in that productivity.
And we thought,
they'd raise our wages or we'd work less time for the same wages. And we're just stuck in this vicious cycle. And it took me a long time to realize it. Because I started, too, with the sort of sob stories about the recession till I realized that it had a pattern.
Yeah, I'm Mike Pesca in for Leonard Lopate on WNYC. We're speaking with Barbara Garson about her book, Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. Bob is calling us from South Brunswick. Bob, I won't ask you to name what percent you're in, but I will welcome you to the show. Hello, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have to say that I totally agree with what she's saying because I've had to live through it. I'm an engineer. I did medical research, did some medical research at some top university hospitals, and have found that through the recession, it's not only gotten impossible to get your foot in the door, it seems that the computers, the way you have to file for applications, it's flooded from, you know, whereas in the past, if you wanted to get a job, you open a newspaper.
Right.
That was a local area. They took out real ads for jobs, and you answered the ad.
Yeah.
Now you're getting inundated by resumes from everywhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, and now computer programs read these resumes. People don't even read the resumes.
Yeah, some of the sad stories I've been telling are people who have sent in thousands of resumes, never get an answer. By the way,
that's
even true to try to get a name. I've talked to people I talk to are clever and interesting, and they work very hard to try to get a name in the company they think it might be so they can actually leave a telephone call. How do you think that feels to them? Whether you're, even if you're just going for a cleanup job in a restaurant, they don't answer unless they need you. They just don't answer. How do you think that feels? And you sometimes begin at the beginning of this process. My Pink Slip Club people all thought, I'm in for this and I'm in for that. I have this many applications. And then they began to realize, I'm not up for anything. I'll never hear back.
Yeah.
I was told that I need to dumb down my resume. I need to take whatever I can get. And just be happy if I'm able to get something.
So what did you do to dumb it down?
Right now I'm in a Work First program through social services, and I'm sitting in the parking lot for lunch.
But with your resume, what did you take off your resume? What's an example of dumbing it down for an engineer?
I have two patents. I took that off.
Wow.
And I want the guy that has...
would think, right?
I want to hire the guy that has two patents.
That's the point. And then two, you can't get through that firewall of taking resumes over the internet. That's really difficult.
Right. Well, thanks for the call, Bob. And from he was talking about all the merits of the old ad in the newspaper. Another one he didn't mention was that newspapers were actually viable industries as maybe a place for journalists to get a job. That seems to have changed. Ramel from Brooklyn. Am I saying your name right, Ramel?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead with your call, and thanks for calling.
Hey, how's it going? Great show. Thank you.
Why the book?
Go ahead, Ramel.
I just wanted to talk about African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
How, you know, historically, the unemployment rate with African Americans has always been lower in this country. I'm curious what her thoughts are.
Well,
good question.
I did not intend to make a chapter about blacks.
Yeah.
But I watched two people lose their houses. I went to court in Richmond, California, and in fact, the person I wasn't going to see, I didn't know about her, just got up in court. She asked the judge, named Alice Epps, a woman, and she said, when will this happen, Your Honor? And he said, the house belongs to them. I made an appointment to meet her that evening because she was rushing right back to her job as a home care aide. And when she came that evening, she had no idea where she would live the next day. And she had run around in circles trying to do that stuff with the Obama modifications.
Yeah.
And impossible to fill out. And I really cried at the end of our conversation because, well, she said to me, I didn't know about coming to see you. I was worried. What is this person about? And then she said, and I prayed on it, mm-hmm. and I said, she's small. She can't hurt me. And I thought, oh, my God. And I just started to cry. And I said, yeah, but I can't help you. My books never help anybody. And she said, I understand. My patients always die. But this woman, she had, in the early part, she had once owned a house entirely. And that was when she had a regular job as a jitney driver for an industrial company. And now that she was a home care aide, that place closed down, and she was a home care aide, she'd sometimes work two shifts, to pay back a mortgage that she foolishly remortgaged her house. I could say it's foolish. She says it's foolish.
Okay.
In order to buy a house, put a down payment for her children. But there was so much swindling in that. I'm sorry, I'm not going to go into the details, but there was so much swindling. And the company was called Litton, I will say that, and they're not going to sue me because they know what they're like, that took her house away from her. And then the other woman in that court that was losing a house was black. And at the time that I was writing this, 11% of black families had already lost homes in this recession. And you know, that's like the crash of the Freedmen's Bank that happened after the Civil War that just wiped out a whole generation's thoughts that they could be work hard and be sort of middle class people too. This just wiped it out.
It is a recession that in many ways is behaving, you know, technically it wasn't the deepest, far from the deepest crater, especially if you use the per capita statistics, but it behaved in weird ways. It hit people very disproportionately.
It's going on to, let me explain, at the most recessions, everything gets contracted, but profits contract as much or little more during a recession than wages.
Corporations feel the pain. Wall Street,
right.
Dow Jones goes
now,
down. We haven't seen that.
In the middle of this recession, and remember my view is that it's the accumulation of money that's the problem right now. In the middle of this recession, it worked the opposite way. And companies prepared not just as they usually do to take a little less profit and hang on till the end. But, for instance, that woman who was working in the boutique, an upscale clothing brand with a flagship on Madison Avenue, during the recession, everyone in the store, and she was a professional sales lady, had been their highest in over 100 stores in the country for many years. During the recession, they turned everybody into a temp. You were given in advance, you were told a week in advance what hours you would work the next week, and there were no more benefits. And I said to her, did they say that that's just for the recession? Thank you for helping us out. And she said to me, no, they're actually hiring more people under this situation. This is how they plan to go forward. So at the end of the recession, a whole group of people were much worse off. She said most of the people with children had to quit, and college kids are coming in for this job. So a whole swath of professional jobs. I mean, she was a professional. She liked to dress people and sell whole outfits, and she was good on petites. That's why she helped me a lot. That's gone.
Yeah, careers have become jobs. Jobs have become gigs.
Now,
and gigs
mind
have
you,
evaporated.
I just want to point out that that's not usually what happens in a recession. This is not, you're right, this was a strange recession because instead of being crash and then build up again, what it was is as if we ran into a deep pothole, climbed out, and continued in the same direction even faster, in the direction of money accumulating as investment money and wages going nowhere.
Well, you've been hearing from Barbara Garson. She says her books never help anybody, but there's a power in the story just being told. Her latest book is called Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live in the Great Recession. It's published by Doubleday. Barbara Garson will be reading and signing books next Thursday night at 7 at Three Lives Bookstore. Address there is 154 West 10th Street. She'll be speaking and signing books on Wednesday, April 17th at 7:30 at the Brecht Forum. That's 451 West Street. Barbara Garson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.